It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, shimmering beetles, cicadas, and moths are the jewels in the patterns of our next guest. We'll find out about her art exhibit called In the Midnight Garden.
But first, it's time for our weekly review of state news. It's the Wisconsin News Roundup.
Governor Walker announced a package of bills this week that aims to help make college more affordable for future students and easier to pay back for former students.
And the state legislature began its 2016 session this week, where a number of new bills were proposed, and there was some drama in the assembly chamber as well. Here with us to talk about all that and more is Robert Menser, storytelling editor for the Wausau Daily Herald and Gannett Central Wisconsin Media. Rob, welcome back.
Hey, thanks.
So earlier this week, Governor Walker announced a number of legislative efforts to bring down the cost of college. This is a topic that has been much talked about in Wisconsin and nationally. What were some of the things that he would like to do?
Yeah, so this is a package of bills, as you say. Probably the most significant one, or one that would affect a large number of people, is ending the cap on the tax deduction that people who are paying student loans can claim on interest payments. Right now, there's a cap on that. The cap is at $2,500, and the proposal is to get rid of that. They say that would help. That specific part of these sort of various pieces of legislation would help 32,000 borrowers in Wisconsin, which I think is kind of in itself a comment on how many people are making very big student loan payments, that there's more than 3,200 people who are paying more than $2,500 in interest in a year.
And I know at least one of these proposals, loan counseling for students and parents, that one has bipartisan support. What about some of the rest of them?
Yeah, it feels to me, so this has been a major, sort of a central issue for Democrats in Wisconsin in recent years. They have introduced bills each year on that deal with sort of student debt. They have a whole slate of bills. And so in general, the Democratic response has been that these proposals don't go far enough, that there needs to be more. They have a proposal that would allow people to refinance student loan debt the way that you can with your mortgage or whatever. If the interest rate goes down, these proposals don't touch anything like that. One of the Democrats, State Senator Jennifer Schilling, called it nibbling around the edges. So that's not the same as saying that they're against these proposals. It's just more that this represents Governor Walker sort of making a little bit of a foray in what had been largely a Democratic issue.
And what is the state of student debt here in Wisconsin? Can you give us a sense of where we are as a state?
So bad, very bad. The is reported that Wisconsin has the third highest number of people with student loan burden, and it has effects. There are economic studies that show that if you have student loans, you're less likely to do things like buy a house or buy a car, as you would expect, right? Hey, listen, I have student loan debt. I'm in this, and it does affect your people's spending decisions. So the argument is that it has an overall drag on the economy when people are carrying around these debts for a decade or whatever.
And another of these I know that we haven't mentioned yet is issuing more grants to technical schools. What do you know about that?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. This is significant as well. It would expand the number of people who can get need-based grants to attend technical colleges. Right now, there are about 37,000 students in the technical college system who are eligible for these need-based grants, but just they can't get them because there just isn't enough money in the fund. That is compared to 24,000 students who received the grant. So there's a large number. It's not quite twice, but it's quite a bit more, you know, as many again, who would be eligible but can't currently get this. And the proposal would increase it by $5,000 per year over some years. So it wouldn't even wipe out that problem either, but it would move it along at least.
We're talking to Robert Menser right now, storytelling editor for the Wausau Daily Herald, talking with him for our Wisconsin News Roundup. And the state legislature started their 2016 session this week. And one of the bills that's been talked about would punish businesses or people who defraud the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation. What can you tell us about where that one is?
Yeah, so here's a bipartisan bill that would make it a felony for companies to provide false information when they're applying for grants, business loans from the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation. Governor Walker this week expressed support for the bill, and given that it's bipartisan, if the governor also likes it, it feels like that's likely to happen. The governor, I mean, is worth saying in his comments, he also sort of downplayed how often this happens and said that it's, you know, in the one or two cases. And he's kind of correct. There isn't, you know, to a large extent, the problem with WEDIC hasn't necessarily been that it's easy for companies to submit false information. In a lot of cases, it's been that the agency doesn't follow up on loans to see if there's the economic growth that they were promised, or the terms of the loan, or that sort of cronyism that's being granted to people who are, you know, campaign supporters. Still, though, I mean, it's something, right? The idea that it's sort of hard to argue that if you defraud the state, that you shouldn't have a penalty for that.
So the new session just started, but do you see any other legislation affecting WEDIC coming down the pike at all?
You know, this is, I think that there certainly will be. This is probably a first start, because it's been it's gotten to the point where there is some bipartisan consensus that procedures need to change. You know, there was at this particular hearing on this bill, there was a business lobbyist who raised the objection that it could have a chilling effect, as if, you know, if you have to, businesses are going to decline to apply for funding if they are at risk of being prosecuted for fraud. But it feels to me like that was a little bit of a half-hearted objection. And, it's something that there's been a lot of focus on. Robin Voss, the Assembly Speaker, has indicated that he is open to further changes beyond this relatively modest proposal. So I wouldn't be surprised to see more coming out of it in the legislative session.
Okay, and in other news this recent week, Representative Bob Gannon was in hot water after giving the finger to Assembly Minority Leader Peter Barca. What happened?
Yeah, how about this guy? Flip somebody off. So Representative Gannon is a Republican from Slinger, and he sort of has a history of making these inflammatory statements. In December, after the shooting at the Easttown Mall in Madison, he issued quite extreme statement calling on Wisconsinites to practice vigilante justice and shoot criminals. I mean, that's what it said. So that was last month. This month, he issued a press release that essentially blamed all of Wisconsin's economic problems on Milwaukee. He wrote in the press release that Milwaukee's unemployment rate among African Americans is about 20%, which is, quote, almost four times as high as the white unemployment rate for the city and the state. So it was like this sort of nakedly racial appeal. And I mean, I think it rubbed a lot of people the wrong way, really on both sides of the aisle, but especially on the Democratic side. So Representative Peter Barca is a Democratic minority leader, and he wanted to argue about it. And instead of arguing, Gannon just flipped him off on the floor of the assembly. So he has apologized for the gesture, but not for the underlying statement or the view that Milwaukee's crime is Wisconsin's main economic problem.
Just real quickly before we leave this, do you think that's seen as sort of an isolated incident, or is that maybe setting the tone for the new session?
Well, I mean, tensions run high, but it does feel like it's somehow symbolic that this is where they are on the first day. This is the first day of the legislative session, and they're already at this level of rancor and inability to like actually debate an issue. So it doesn't augur well, you know.
And Rob, just briefly, as we wrap up, yesterday we talked to State Senator Mary Lozick about a bill that would allow concealed carry weapons on school grounds. According to Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, doesn't sound like that bill is going to be moving forward anytime soon, but can you give us a quick update there?
Sure, yeah. I heard that segment. So today Representative Robin Voss was quoted saying that he did not think it was likely that the Assembly would take up the bill. He did say that he supports the concept. But he said he was not sure that we were seeing an outpouring of support around the state for concealed carry on school grounds. So if it doesn't pass the Assembly, it's unlikely to become law. He didn't completely rule it out, but it sounds like its chances aren't great.
Rob, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Robert Mensah. He joins us every week at this time to break down the biggest stories from around the state in our Wisconsin News Roundup.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert.
The unique artwork of a UW-Madison professor is being honored with an installation in the newly reopened Renwick Gallery at the Smithsonian American Art Museum. Her exhibit there is called In the Midnight Garden. It's part of a broader show called Wonder.
Jennifer Angus works with pattern, and her medium is insects. Not your usual Wisconsin bugs, but glorious rainforest insects with shimmering colors like beetles and moths and cicadas. And she joins us now in studio. Jennifer, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Well, for those of us who are not going to be able to make it to this exhibit in Washington, D.C. to see In the Midnight Garden, can you describe it for us? What would we see if we walked in?
Well, you would be surrounded in pink. It is the only gallery that actually has been painted a color other than the standard sort of museum gray. And that's perhaps what draws people's attention first. And so perhaps I should speak about that pink color, because it actually comes from an insect that's called cochineal. It's actually used in the food industry and cosmetic industry to color red, to make things red or pink. So if anyone's wearing lipstick today, they may well have a little bit of bug juice on their lips. And so I used that insect to color the walls. I simply made an extract from it. And then beyond that, upon the pink walls is a pattern that runs around the bottom, sort of as a wainscoting, a kind of diagonal created of cicadas. And then above that, one sees skulls that are comprised of about 400 insects per skull. And then beyond that, there's a kind of starburst or fireworks of insects that swirl around the room. So I really feel that the pattern grounds things, and then as you go higher up the wall, sort of chaos takes over.
And I've read that people have these interesting reactions to this, because at first they're looking at a pattern, but as you get closer, you realize that you're in close proximity with these. These are real insects. These are not prototypes. These are not models. These are insects.
That's true. I think that most people from a distance, they recognize the imagery, and then they get closer and they have that kind of aha moment. And frequently in my exhibitions, I see people walk right up and then they realize what it is and take a step backwards. So you are most definitely surrounded and kind of caught in the whirlwind of these insects.
Well, when did you first get the idea to work with bugs like this? Because your background is pattern and textile.
That's right. I actually, and that my interest comes from research in textiles. In the mid-80s, I was doing research in northern Thailand on tribal minority dress in the area known as the Golden Triangle. And within that region, there are many different ethnic minority groups. And I was essentially photo documenting the traditional dress. And I came across a garment, it's a shawl, and it had a fringe in which the person who made it had strung the green metallic beetle wings. That for me, that was a kind of revelation. First off, you know, I grew up in Canada, which is not dissimilar than Wisconsin, that most insects I knew, other than butterflies, I was not friends with. They were black, brown, bite, sting. And so to know that there were beautiful insects, that was a revelation. And then I appreciated the ingenuity of using what was essentially at hand in place of beads or sequins. And the wonderful thing about the shawl was that when it's worn and the person moves, the wings are so hard that they make a kind of jingling type sound. So it was remarkable. And I found that the more I looked for insects on textiles, they were there. You know, whether it was adorning a headdress or a garment. In fact, the Queen of Thailand wore a dress in which these same green metallic beetle wings adorned the entire dress. Must have been a cocktail dress. There's no way you could sit down on it. And then everybody wanted to have one of these. So there is a tradition of insects and textiles. And so I always say I came to insects from a legit place in the textile world. But of course, pattern is my passion. And eventually I found that I was just more and more interested in the insects, and I went, oh, I'm going to combine my interests. And that's kind of how this was born, simply on a whim. I'm going to put the insects in patterns and let's see what happens.
Well, we're talking right now with Jennifer Angus. She's a professor in the Design Studies Department at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and she's one of nine artists that have been selected to exhibit their work in the reopening of the Smithsonian's Renwick Gallery. This is after a two-year closure for renovation. Record attendance at this exhibit, I hear. People are really being drawn in.
It's amazing. It's absolutely amazing that I believe they had estimated 200,000 people would attend the exhibition, and now they've upped it to 500,000. And I think one of the most remarkable things for people who are regular museum goers, you're used to seeing signs that say no photography. And at the Renwick, it's in fact, photography is encouraged. There are signs that say that clearly indicate that. So there's been a bit of controversy. So many people are taking pictures, taking selfies. In fact, I discovered that two people had their wedding pictures taken in my installation, which was it was an honor. And then I thought, wow, those are really bizarre pictures.
Well, that explains why I've seen so many. So I went on Flickr actually to look for some pictures. And usually if it's an official exhibit, you don't see anything, but there were a lot of pictures up there. So if anyone's curious, you can check it out online. And I want to ask you a little bit about where you get the insects before we leave the insects. Where do you get them, and how do you decide which ones that you want, which ones, because you put this all together with an artist's eye?
Right. Well, the insects come from specimen dealers. Sadly, I'm not out in the jungle collecting them myself.
It would take forever.
It would. That would be a whole nother career. So that's where they come from. They don't come to me ready to go on the wall. I have to do what's known as relaxing them, which is essentially rehydrating them so that then I can move their wings or their legs and pin them into position. They dry, and then they stay that way. As far as what insects I choose, when I started this quite some time ago, I would get a thick catalog that was full of Latin names. And so I had to do quite a bit of research. But now with the internet, you can put in a name and most times come up with a picture. But I know for me, the insects, as criteria is that they have to be hardy. The insects are reused from exhibition to exhibition. So for the show at the Renwick, there are approximately 200, maybe 300 new insects. All the others have been used again and again. And in fact, the insects making up the skull motif are a weevil. They are the very first insect I ever started using.
A weevil?
Yes. It's called Eupholis bonetti. They are a weevil that comes from Papua New Guinea, and they're so prized by collectors that they've actually been farmed. So those are my oldest insects that have been going for close to 20 years, and that's quite remarkable. That says a lot for their hardiness. Weevils are in the beetle family, and so they have that hard protection. So they have held up well. So that's a criteria. When I first started working, I thought the pattern on their bodies would be important. Now I know that it's how I arrange them, their wings, their legs, and their proximity. That positive and negative space is really what forms the pattern. And I like to use the ones that mimic leaves, and that's a whole family, the leaf mimic. So those are how I select.
Now, I've read that once in a while someone questions you about the lives of the insects, thousands, maybe more, hundreds of thousands, I don't know, that go into a big exhibit like this. But you, it sounds like, see this as an ecological mission as well. How do you answer those concerns?
Well, I honestly, I don't know how you could walk into the exhibition and not question that. And I think it's a fantastic question. And really, that's what I'm hoping to do, is provoke discussion. In the Midnight Garden refers to the doomsday clock. And we all know we're a couple minutes before midnight. And the skulls refer to man's mortality, and which is closely linked to the environment. So we know all the terrible things. The rainforest is being cut down at a tremendous rate. So for those who are upset, I'd say, fantastic. Do something. I'm doing something. I'm getting people to talk about this. And so I see it really as a kind of public service. Some people would disagree that, you know, that it's a kind of, you know, how do you protect the environment if you're taking things from the environment? But the bottom line is that insects are a renewable resource if they have a habitat. And that's the most important thing. If we preserve the habitat, then insects will continue to reproduce at the tremendous amounts that they tend to do. We all heard the thing where if you see one cockroach, there's 100 you're not seeing. That's true for most insect species.
And Jennifer, just quickly before we wrap up, how much longer is the exhibit running?
You have until the first week of May, May 8th, the show will be up.
And will you be putting up anything closer to home here in Wisconsin?
Actually, tonight, if you're in the Appleton area, the opening of An Unnamed Need, Pattern and Beauty in Contemporary Art is opening up at the Riston Galleries at Lawrence University.
Well, perfect. Thanks for telling us, and thank you for coming to the studio.
My pleasure.
That was Jennifer Angus, professor in the Design Studies Department at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She was one of 9 artists who was picked to exhibit her work for the reopening of Smithsonian's Renwick Gallery after a 2-year closure for renovation.
I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret.
The United States has 2.2 million people in prison with an annual cost of $80 billion. A major report released by the National Research Council in 2014 documented that the tripling of the prison population since 1980 was produced by changes in policy, not crime rates.
Joining us now is Mark Maurer. He's executive director of the Sentencing Project, a Washington, D.C.-based nonprofit that works for sentencing reform. He's proposing a way to relieve the prison system by capping the maximum prison sentence for most offenders at 20 years in state and federal prisons. Mark, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
Before we get to your solution or partial solution to the problem, the United States has more people incarcerated, I understand, than any other country. Can you talk about how we got here and what it costs us?
Well, it's true that it was largely changes in policy over the last 35 years or so that produced this world record prison population. Essentially, policies made at the federal level, Congress in all states, to send more people to prison and keep them there for longer periods of time. So variously, it's gone under names of mandatory sentencing, truth in sentencing, three strikes and you're out, the impact of the war on drugs and vastly increasing the number of drug offenders in prison. It's been a very conscious strategy. Nobody, legislators set out and said, let's create mass incarceration, but they did say, let's get tough, and the way we're going to get tough on crime is to put more people in prison.
Well, the idea is that the risk of going to prison would be a deterrent to most forms of crime, and that having the people who committed those crimes in prison means that they aren't out committing more crime. So is this an effective method of crime reduction?
Well, it, you know, prison has some effect on crime, of course. If you have 2 million people behind bars, you're bound to be preventing some crimes, but, you know, a lot of what happens depends very much on who we lock up in prison. You know, think of two offenders. One is a serial rapist who's terrorizing a neighborhood. The police catch him. He's convicted in court, sent to prison. We've put one person in prison, but we've had some real effect on crime. Another offender is a kid on the street corner selling drugs. The police come by. They do an undercover buy from him, convict him being a drug seller, send him off to prison, too. In this case, we've also sent one person to prison, but what happens back on that street corner where he was picked up? Well, in most neighborhoods where people are selling drugs, it's going to take about 20 minutes until somebody else steps up to try to meet the demand for drugs in that neighborhood. So we don't have the same effect every time we send someone to prison, and increasingly we've been sending less serious people to prison. We've been sending people to prison for whom we could respond in other ways, and incarceration is very expensive. You know, we have to think about what else could we do with some of that money.
Let's get into an idea you wrote about just earlier this month, I think it was, the idea of, for most, not quite all, but most offenders, a maximum sentence you'd like to see at the federal and state level, a maximum sentence of 20 years. Why make the case for that?
Well, one of the many reasons that we have mass incarceration now is at the deep end of the system, the use of life imprisonment, we've also set new records there. So today, one of every nine people in prison nationally is serving a life sentence, 160,000 people, some of them with a possibility of parole, some would never get out on parole. In addition to that, there are many people serving virtual life sentences. These are sentences of 40, 50, 60 years that essentially mean these people never get out. And yes, the vast majority of these people have committed serious crimes, but the problem is we know from scientific research over many generations, people age out of crime. There's sort of a spike involvement in crime in the late teens, early 20s. This starts to decline quite sharply by the mid to late 20s. Essentially, people grow up, they take on adult roles and the like. So the 20-year-old sent to prison, whether it's for stealing a car, committing a robbery, by the time he's 30, 35, 40, if he has a long sentence, is much less of a risk for public safety than that younger person was. So what happens with these very long sentences is that for each succeeding year we keep somebody behind bars, we're preventing less crime, and we're doing it at increasingly greater cost. Certainly when we get up to the point where people are 50 and 60 years old, increasing costs of health care can double or triple the annual cost of incarceration as well. So from a public safety point of view, from a fiscal point of view, sentences of more than 20 years are generally very counterproductive.
Talking to Mark Maurer from the Sentencing Project about part of the solution, he says, to too many people being incarcerated in the United States, cap the maximum prison sentence at 20 years for most offenders. And you make the case in that piece I referenced, Mark, that we're losing something when we're paying for, especially those older inmates you just mentioned, that's resources that could be better spent maybe with prevention programs, addiction treatment, things to help people not commit crimes that would be less expensive in the long run.
Yeah, well, you know, resources are finite. As you pointed out, we're spending $80 billion a year on the prison system. There are a range of ways that we deal with public safety. Public safety is a function of good schools, it's good job opportunities, it's good cultural programs, good health care, and also a criminal justice system. And what's happened over the last several decades is that we've put enormous resources at the back end of the system into incarceration and really robbing communities of resources at the front end. So how do we better invest with families and communities to give them the skills, to give them the services and opportunity to produce better outcomes for public safety? You know, we have a tremendous shortage of substance abuse treatment programs. We have a tremendous shortage of mental health programs in the community. All of these kinds of issues, not the sole cause involved in crime, but they're certainly contributing factors. And if we could begin to reduce the excessive incarceration we have, divert resources to more proactive, more preventive measures, we'd have better outcomes for public safety overall, and we'd avoid so many of the harms that come through excessive incarceration as well.
Is anybody around the world doing this kind of thing, this 20-year-ish maximum sentence?
Well, in most other industrialized nations, I think it's fair to say they look at U.S. policies with a great deal of shock and outrage. The United States is virtually the only industrialized nation still maintains the death penalty. Our use of life imprisonment dwarfs that of any other nation. You take a country like Norway. Norway sets a maximum of 21 years in prison for any offense. And just a few years ago, there was that horrendous crime, that man named Anders Breivik, who shot and murdered 77 people one afternoon in Oslo, many of them young people. He was sentenced to the maximum of 21 years in prison. The way it's set up in Norway is that after that period of 21 years, if a person is still believed to be a danger to public safety, they can be held for 5 years and then reviewed again for an additional 5 years. So they have mechanisms in place to consider risk and public safety, but the general approach, cultural approach that they have is that 21 years is a long period of time in a person's life, and in the vast majority of cases, the risk to public safety is very much diminished by that point.
And if the United States were to do something like this, as you'd like to see it happen, would we have a similar policy in place where there might be a review? I think you mentioned in your piece the case maybe of a unrepentant serial rapist who refuses any kind of treatment. Might be somebody who would stay longer than that 20 years in that case.
Right. You could set up various mechanisms. You know, today in most states we have parole boards which are considering questions like this on a regular basis, taking into account risk assessments, doing it in a scientific manner, in a qualitative manner, looking at these issues. So you could have some mix of a parole board or a mix of mental health professionals reviewing these cases. I think it would be the exceptional case that would require this additional amount of time to be incapacitated. But right, the extreme cases where a person is so clearly a risk to the community, in those cases you could identify them and try to deal with that. But I think the vast majority of cases after 20 years, we could safely have them back in the community. It also suggests, I think, that you know, we want to be thinking more about people returning to the community, whether people go to prison for stealing a car or committing an armed robbery or anything in between. You know, we know that 95% of the people who go to prison are coming home someday. So regardless of how much time they're spending in prison, it behooves us to try to figure out what can we do while the person's incarcerated? What do we do in that transition back to the community to reduce the risk of reoffending? And that's not a liberal or conservative point of view. That's a very practical approach to saying, you know, we need safe communities. We need to care about what goes on inside prison if we want to improve public safety.
We're talking with Mark Maurer. He's executive director of the Sentencing Project, about his proposal for a maximum state and federal prison sentence of 20 years for most offenders.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What do you think about this proposal for a 20-year maximum prison sentence? Give us a call at 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard, and we're continuing our conversation with Mark Maurer, executive director of the Sentencing Project, about his proposed minimum prison sentence of 20 years.
That maximum prison sentence of 20 years, we want to hear what you think of it at 800-642-1234. What do you think about this proposal, this idea of capping prison sentences, federal and state, for almost all offenders at 20 years at most? Have you experienced the correction system as an inmate, a corrections officer yourself? What do you think of this idea? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go to our callers now. Jim is with us in Wisconsin Dells. Jim, hi.
Hi. Glad to be able to talk to you folks. I was part of the system from the inside as an inmate, although we're called patients at the time, residents. There was a program in the 70s that rather than going to prison, we were sentenced to Central State Hospital, which was a mental facility. And although it basically was run as a prison, the staff was controlled not by a warden, but by a psychiatrist and so on, social workers. And we had constant reviews. As a matter of fact, by law, our case had to be reviewed every 11 months. We went before a review board, and they would either let you go or they would extend you for another 11 months. So the 20 years is fine, but you don't need that. I think you just need a system that regularly deals with people and reviews them on a constant basis. A year at a time is really a long time for someone to be working if they're truly being rehabilitated. Plus, one more comment. A crime is not the means that you should judge someone for going away. It should be the fact that he's done something wrong, he's done something antisocial, and regardless of what the crime is,
Jim, thanks a lot for the call. A lot there to get into, Mark. First of all, his idea that, like at a psychiatric hospital, then maybe the idea of regular reviews of a particular inmate, it sounds like it'd be a lot of work and a lot of judgment calls, though. It might be hard to implement, Mark. What do you think?
Well, we are making judgment calls in the system all the time, and I think he's right. You know, people can change fairly quickly. I know when I go into prisons and meet with inmates there, there are many people who've been, running around with the wrong crowd out on the streets. They get in prison, and it's not a nice place to be, but some of them are able to reflect on their lives and thinking about it and can make changes, within the first couple of years that they're there. And so, we should be looking very carefully at how people go about making changes, what kinds of services we can offer to give them, the skills they need to make it on the outside, and, thinking about, if the goal is to get people going home, how can we do that the most efficient way possible? And I think in order to make that decision, we do need regular reviews. Not everybody needs to be in a psychiatric hospital, of course, but whatever the institution is, we should be staying on top of that to see what kind of progress people are making. And also, there's a real deficit of programming in most prison systems, too, and our legislatures need to pay attention to that as well. Putting people in a prison cell, not providing services, doesn't help anybody.
Mental health services you're talking about. Mental health services you're talking about.
Well, mental health services, but it's also drug treatment, it's anger management, it's educational programming, vocational training. It's a range of things, and obviously we want to individualize it depending on the person's needs.
Jim, thanks for that call and for sharing your experiences. We'll go to Kevin in Verona now. Kevin, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking the call. I think the 20-year sentence cap is a really great idea, but to me it seems not even remotely close enough with regard to change that needs to happen in the quote-unquote criminal justice system. I think, if we did do that cap, we'd have more money to spend on people that need help in probation and things like that. For example, I spent some time in the probation system. I didn't spend any time in jail or prison, but the probation agents were way overworked, and they had too many cases, and they couldn't give the attention they needed to each individual case, and I was held on probation much longer than I should have been because of the lack of workers. But also, beyond that, even, we have so many things that are crimes based on some ideological standpoint or religious belief that really has no practical scientific reason for being a crime, for instance. So many drugs that are illegal that really all the evidence shows them being illegal is more harmful than what the drug might actually do to an individual, family, or society. And I think our entire system needs more or less a complete overhaul, but I really do appreciate that somebody is making a call for at least some sensible scientific data-related policy changes like 20-year sentencing.
Kevin, thanks a lot for the call. Mark Maurer from the Sentencing Project. More resources into a probation type of situation where you're supervising a person but not having them in a prison.
Yeah, well, I think he's absolutely right. When probation began, well over 100 years ago, the idea was very much a person didn't need to be behind bars, but the probation officer would help them gain the skills they need, the connections, the peer networks, and the like. It was supposed to be, providing services, helping the people get back on the right path. Today, because the whole justice system has exploded so much, so many probation officers have very high caseloads, and in far too many situations, all they're doing is really supervising people and checking through. So they have them come in, they do a drug test, and they make sure that they're working or in school, wherever they're supposed to be, but they have much less time and resources to make up for those deficits in people's skills and all that. So if we could shift resources, if we could cut back on the numbers of people don't need to be in prison or on probation, then we could do more intensive work. We could do more constructive work all around. And, we're sort of caught in this vicious cycle right now, and it's time to really think about how to reverse that pattern.
And he mentioned changing drug policy briefly. Is that part of the solution here?
Well, you know, there's a debate going on about our drug policy, you know, ranging from we have to keep things sending a tough message and have record numbers of people in prison with drugs, and legalization and decriminalization on the other end. I think there's an awful lot we could do towards moving to a more public health model. Whether or not anyone believes in decriminalization or legalization, we could do things much more appropriately. Right now we have mandatory penalties that apply to a lot of drug offenses. You can talk to judges around the country who will give you cases over and over of people they were obligated to sentence to prison for 5, 10, 20 years who they believed were not deserving of so much time, or society didn't need that, but these mandatory penalties that apply frequently in drug offense require them to do so. So we really need to look at an overhaul of how we think about punishment, how do we individualize our approach to offenders, and yes, we want to shift much more to prevention and treatment when it comes to substance abuse, and it's also a question of economic opportunity. Some people are selling drugs, but not drug users themselves. And in many low-income communities, unfortunately, it's become viewed as a source of economic opportunity when there are not many other options around.
We'll take another caller now. We've got Jacob on the line in La Crosse. Jacob, hi. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
What do you think?
Well, I think that the 20-year maximum sentencing is a terrible idea. A lot of these guys, I worked in the prison system in a maximum security institution for 7+ years, and I've seen a lot come and go, and a lot of guys come in with the idea that when they get back out, they're just going to go back to the lifestyle that they had, whether that be the life of crime or selling drugs or dealing with hardcore narcotics. I think that releasing people from prison on a mandatory maximum sentencing just gives the criminal aspect the idea that it doesn't matter what the crime they commit, that they're going to get out no later than 20 years. And if they have a shabby life on the street anyway, it's not going to affect their judgment at all.
Jacob, thanks for the call. So, Mark, as we wrap up, this will be a worry for a lot of people, that it'll lower the deterrent factor of prison and it's going to put hardened criminals back on the streets.
Well, we shouldn't discount how long 20 years is. You know, think back what we've been doing for the last 20 years in our lives. That's, you know, a good part of a lifetime. And I think there's not too many people say, oh, what the hell, I can just do 20 years, be back out on the streets. I think if we give them incentives to pick up skills, to think differently, the vast majority of people are capable of changing their lives around and doing something constructive when they get out.
Jacob, thanks for the call. And Mark Maurer, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
That was Mark Maurer. He's the executive director of the Sentencing Project, a Washington, D.C.-based nonprofit that works for sentencing reform. We've been talking about his proposal, and we've got a link to a piece he wrote about a maximum federal and state prison sentence of 20 years.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. News is coming up next on Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.